So I'm here with Sam, and we're going to talk about today issues in forensics and digital forensics, issues and issues in InfoSec, and sort of what is it, looking at InfoSec not just from a securing data perspective, but also investigation and sort of trying to understand the tools that investigators use and the tools that adversaries use. So let's start off with, give us a sort of basic definition of data, because I think with this NSA controversy, we've been hearing a lot about data, metadata, and then I think in your blog you wrote about proto data. So give
Right.
us, try to, what are the differences, what's the definition of data, and then what are the sort of differences between the three categories?
So the thing that we talk about with data a lot of the times is that we data is what we construct information from. Information gives us content and context. Those are how we kind of construct most of what we talk about. So people sometimes use databases. You have fields and databases, and then you have records and databases, and those records all have data that describes them, which we call metadata. So another way we look at it is, when you put this podcast out, it'll be a recording, and the metadata is how long the podcast is. The metadata is how many bits per second you're using, what the quality level is, those kind of things. If you have an icon attached to it, there'll be some data that points off to that. Those are the metadata items. In some ways, metadata is a lot more descriptive than even the content when you start looking at things like motive, means, and opportunity, the three things we look at in any crime. So if you have a call that goes out from a cell phone, there's certain pieces of metadata attached to that: the length of the call, the person called, who the originating station ID of the phone, the location of the call, the location of the recipient are all pieces of metadata that you can get off of a mobile-to-mobile phone call. Well, if I want to create a social network graph of a political adversary, what a great way to do it. I don't have to have the content, which is protected more stringently. I can use just the metadata to go after that kind of stuff. So metadata is the piece that we've been talking about with NSA. Protodata is something else, and protodata was something I ran across a long time ago at an intelligence conference talking about big data and data processing. So it comes out of the idea of how total information assurance or total information awareness works. And what they were looking at was the idea of you have information, you have data that makes up that information, you have little pieces, atomic elements that make up that stuff. That's all well and good. What is the describer of your query? What is a describer of your hypothesis? And what is the data that makes up that hypothesis? What is the data you have before you have data? And so if you think about a hypothesis and how you structure that, you can nullify the hypothesis, you can do a lot of other things, but the things that construct that hypothesis become important. We do it a lot in programming when we have y equals 2 plus x. That why is your hypothesis that you're working towards by providing the rest of the formula. So you create those. So that idea of protodata is what is the data you have before you ask the question. And it's kind of an interesting place to look at. I've never seen it in scholarly writing. I've never seen it out really, other than a couple of things that have nothing to do with the concept we're talking here. I've only heard it in that context that the Intel guys were looking at it. And so to me, it's just kind of an interesting sideline to the information theory.
Interesting. So, how do you analyze the data? I mean, it seems like on one hand we have a forensics approach where, the crime has been committed or, the event has occurred, and then we look at the sort of results.
So,
I mean, versus go ahead.
I say so when you look at analysis, there's a couple of strategies. Every law enforcement officer ever trained gets taught in basic criminology, basic criminalistics. And they're used to laying things out in a timeline, literally a timeline, just like you did when you were in first grade and they said, history, timeline, sail, Columbus gets in boat, Columbus arrives in North America, timeline. So what we do is we put together a case based on that timeline and we say, we know that there was no event here. We know that there was an event here. What happened between those two? What was the time of the event? How long did it last? How long? What is the evidence you gather at each point? And you start ended up with little spurs coming off of that. So analyzing data is no different. Now there are tools. Computers are not perfect, and Licard's principle of information remaining behind isn't perfect with computers. But you can look at a computer or look at a digital device or look at a piece of machinery even and see a timeline of when events happened, working your way down from the opportunity aspects to the means that somebody used to do some nefarious activity. So,
go ahead.
I say, so tools are like Splunk is a tool that we use for that. There's various timeline tools in the forensic toolkits that we use, like a forensic toolkit or NCASE or other things that allow you to do that and analyze by log files and analyze changes to the metadata of a system to allow you to know when something happened.
So when does that sort of approach switch into predictive approaching? It seems like, you know, with sort of big data and sort of the use of data sets that are, you know, millions of points of information. I mean, when does that forensics approach sort of become a predictive approach, if any? I mean, is that something? Oh, go ahead.
I say so. Forensics is never predictive. Okay, so forensics in of itself is a subdiscipline of the law, and so it is always about response to a crime that's already occurred. It's after bad stuff has happened, you use forensics. However, the same tools can be used for intelligence, which is the idea of looking at evidence that is occurring and predicting what the next step in the chain would be. And a really good example of that is Visa fraud protection. They look at the data coming in and the metadata of data coming in and evaluate that stream from your credit card as an example and say, we predict that this is going to be used for fraudulent means, or we think based on previous data that it's currently being used for fraudulent means. A really good way to kick off Visa's fraud protection is to go make a small purchase at a gas station that doesn't do pump verification and then go buy a pair of tennis shoes. They know after so much time that if they see one, then the other, then the card will be followed on, used for significant crime where you'll see large-scale purchases being made with the card. And so that's predictive, using the data as a predictive measure.
So, I mean, in terms of sort of analyzing the data and sort of trying to understand, you know, a crime or an action, I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, importance, I mean, which one would you say is more important or less important? Or do you say that really the ability to sort of analyze something that has happened and the ability to predict and collect intelligence are both equally important within sort of the context of, you know, digital crime and digital forensics?
So the way that I would explain it is this. The document says, we're going to go rob the bank at 2:00. Be ready. The email or whatever. That is the smoking gun. That's the thing that says a crime has occurred. When somebody downloads inappropriate artwork from the internet, that is the crime that they have committed. The metadata is the when they did it, the how they did it, the where they got it from, the proof that they were the entity that pulled the trigger, so to speak. And that's how we use it. That's why when people say, oh, it's just metadata, I kind of giggle, is because that's all the stuff that proves you were a bad person. And it's very powerful because with enough metadata, I can do things in the intelligence side like predictive analytics.
So let me sort of switch a little and sort of give us a broad picture, because I think for a lot of people, you know, the NSA controversy has brought metadata, you know, very publicly and to a lot of people. But, you know, give us a basic history. I mean, how has digital forensics has changed? I mean, if based on your previous sort of, you know, the answer you gave us, I mean, you know, how has it changed in the last 30 years? I mean, it seems like going from a Commodore 486 to, you know, cloud computing or, you know, big data sets to social media. I mean, there has been huge shifts in, you know, how we do forensics. So, I mean, could you walk us through that basic history?
So back in the 1980s, when I did my first computer forensics case, we didn't call it computer forensics. It's, hey, dude, do you know how a computer works? it was pretty basic stuff. And they handed me, at that time, an 8086 computer, an XT, and said, hey, Sam, take a look at this computer. We think something's up. We think this guy's running a book operation, but we found this thing. We don't know how to even get into it. Can you help us out? And so I grabbed the computer, and my investigation involved turning the computer on, going to the C prompt at that time. Actually, it was A prompt because it was only floppy drives in that computer. And looking at the files and finding a file that was named client, okay, .txt, because it was a MS-DOS variant at that time. It might have been PR-DOS. But the... you know, and finding that on a file, on a floppy, in flat text, a list of all the names, what they owed, and what their payouts were, and their total. So it was basically a tabulation sheet for a bookie. And so there, we didn't use metadata. We didn't do a lot. It was, can you find the data so that we can call them? And bookies at that time used call codes, I think is what they called them. And they were like their phone numbers of the guy, so they could call them up and say, hey, you know, you owe us, or whatever. Of course, those went to landline, so once you had a phone number, you knew pretty much who the subscriber to the phone was in general. So there wasn't a lot of investigation that went in there. It wasn't sexy, and we didn't use expensive tools. And to be quite honest, our process was pretty rugged. It was pretty much not a good process. You go forward in the 1990s, and we're working on cases and in the private sector, not in government. What we're trying to do is do labor stuff. So we've got a guy doing something where he shouldn't be doing something, or maybe we think that he's working with a competitor, and we're grabbing computers. And now we're starting to look at things like, is it, you know, we're getting into the idea of network computers, and we're starting to look at more data. We're looking at log files. We're looking to see if there was access to the computer. Does it have a modem? Does it have a lot of other things? And we're starting to think about the process. You know, if we have to go to court, we want to make sure that we can go to court. You get some interesting cases coming along about that time, setting the rules for it. So how you do forensics. You have some interesting things saying, at that point in time, nobody has any rights. If you own the computer and they're a business person, they don't have any rights to it, so you don't have to have any kind of searches or warrants on them. Now you have things where people have rights to the computers, even if the company owns them. There's a lot of things that have gone on in the case world, because it's a subdiscipline of law, that sets boundaries on the behaviors. So now you go forward to today, and you have multiple agents accessing any entity's computer. You know, back even in the modem days, it was pretty rare for anybody but the user of the computer to initiate a network connection. Well, you know, here we are. We're using voice over IP to talk to each other. And I've got agents in the background that are checking to make sure that my computer's up to date, that are running autonomously. I've got iTunes running in the background. I've got other tools that are running in the background. I'm being billed for some things. I might have a variety of communication tools that are all running through my computer all at one time. With new Apple technology, MacBook Pros and things like that, they don't even sleep. They actually check for mail while they're off. So they're off often running. And some of that's new technology to the consumer, but even with our mainframe servers from the 90s, we had things like lights out management, which ran in the background all the time and allowed for third-party access. So now we have to create from all the metadata and all the data. We can find the data and say a crime has occurred, but attributing that crime becomes more difficult because we have to use all the metadata to create the trail to say that the individual behind the keyboard is the one that did something.
So how has the diversity of, you know, of operating systems and platforms changed forensics? I mean, is it, you know, you make mention that, you know, of servers and computers of, you know, I'm assuming laptops and desktops, but where do we put, you know, cell phones, storage that isn't the data is the person, but the actual storage is somebody else, like Dropbox or Google. You know, how do we, in this very complex sort of environment, you know, how has that sort of changed forensics, both as an academic quantity and as it's practiced in the field?
So it's changed things substantially in some ways and not at all in others. An interesting phenomenon that's happening is if you look at PCs and Macs, is even though the operating system has substantial differences between a Windows operating system and a Macintosh OS X operating system, they are the hardware layer itself is very close. They're not as diversified as they once were with PowerPC architecture versus x86 architecture. So the hardware platforms are coming together. We're seeing the same thing in the mobile space where similar processors are being used and similar methods of memory management. And what's really interesting is that laptops and desktops and those mobile devices are actually starting to merge into one hardware platform with specialization coming out of that. So I think that's where we're going. We're going to a real convergence. And that's nothing new. We've had that since the 80s where we've been converging many devices into one. So we'll probably end up with, at some point in time, some kind of converged device that people use, and then the user interface is the only thing that's different between that. And even Motorola had an actual phone that was at a plug-in to a laptop that allowed you to use the phone as the processing element, and then you'd have a display and keyboard for it, or you'd use it as a phone or a tablet or whatever. So the convergence is what is occurring there. What's interesting now to me as a researcher is the mobile side of things. It's getting harder and harder to buy a flip phone or a simple cell phone in and of itself because smartphones have taken over the world. And you know, we often talk about the grandma problem. Well, my mom is a grandma, and she likes flip phones. But her next phone likely is not going to be one because it's hard to find one. So we're seeing that the mobile side of forensics take off. But there are, you know, every time we see a rapid advancement in that phase, it's really interesting because there's immediately tools available for it. So those tools are the chasing the changes, but the principles, the basic understanding of how these technologies are working, haven't changed that much. It's just protocols here and there might change, but the investigation side remains fairly consistent.
So I'm curious then, how is the diversity of looking at it, not from a investigative standpoint, but a sort of attack standpoint. I mean, how has the diversity of malware, hacking techniques, and sort of variation in actors, how has that changed forensics? I mean, it seems like, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, it was, you know, not super limited. It was a sort of limited set of people who would be able to engage in hacking. But now it seems like, you know, you have the knowledge that's out there, and anybody with, you know, can Google Nmap or Google Metasploit, or even, you know, can sort of understand what a cross-scripting attack is. So, I mean, you know, how has that diversity changed, you know, the way that we approach forensics?
Well, I think it's an interesting two pieces to that. One is that the number of creators of this stuff hasn't changed substantially. There's a friend of mine, Dr. Rogers, a colleague here at Purdue, he actually wrote a paper about the idea of the different levels of hackers that you have out in the environment. And you've got to understand that I come from the old world. So when I remember clearly when 2600 Magazine and Black Hat Magazine and all those first came out back in like 86 or something like that. Maybe it was 84. I remember when those things came out. So I've got a little bit of history here that tugs me back to the old days. You know, I get all misty, I think about it. The thing that happens is the number of creators of the tools hasn't significantly changed. You still have a small number of people creating them and a much larger group of people using them. So if you think about it, all that's happened is the sophistication of the secondary user community has increased. And part of that is the use case and the functionality of seeing the stuff out there. The user interfaces for a lot of the tools out there have really solidified around a standard, even though nobody ever wrote one. A lot of the icons, terms used, concepts of how the tools are used are really standardized in many ways around the original Windows standard is what, if you look at them, you go like, ah, I can see the original Windows standard in a lot of these things. Part of that's because of the frameworks they use to actually build the tools, or build out of Visual Studio, or they're built out of the X Windows library, or the X library for Linux, or whatever group or front end you want to use. So that standardization has allowed access. But I've seen that same access not just in hacking, but everywhere else. You know, one of my top grad students at Purdue isn't an IT guy. He isn't a CS guy. He's a chemistry guy. And he didn't have formalized C++ classes or Java classes or C# classes. He had to learn those things along the way just to do his chemistry. So the exposure to the software, the side of writing code, he's been exposed to that for a long time. I've got physics students the same way. I've got mathematics students the same way. And that's kind of an interesting piece, because now the community out there, that secondary community of users, is exploding in growth. If you look at Snowden, he didn't have any formal training from anybody. He was supposedly had a GED and some certificates. I don't know which ones. I didn't really follow up that close, but that idea, that secondary community growing up, it's part of that is what we call the youth worship, but part of it also is just the use case out there. Everybody has computers now. So if you want to look it up, you can do it and follow the path. And I like to use my kids as an example. I've got twins. I've got two 13-year-old boys. Both of them can program extensively in C++ and Java and have been doing so since they were 8 or 9 years old. That's computer literacy 101. What's really funny to me is that our CS students and our IT students are learning things like C# and Java, whereas these other students that don't have the computing classes, aren't taking computing classes, are using much more basic and powerful languages like C++ and C based on our needs to use things like R, or to use MATLAB or other things to be able to get inside and create modules for those. It's kind of interesting to me.
So then, where would you put hacktivists and corporations then? I'm curious, because it seems like if we've generalized the knowledge to the point where, you know, anybody could Google, can learn to use Nmap and Metasploit, I mean, you know, is the real difference then sort of, you know, the amount of finance behind an actor and the political motivations? I mean, I know this question seems basic, but it really seems like, you know,
it's not basic at all.
Go ahead.
So in Western culture, we focus on monetary and profit motives as primary mechanisms of radicalization, for ideology concerns for radicalization. We focus on the profit motives for the idea of motive. But that really is a denigration against society in general and youth culture in general. You know, if you're a 20-something and somebody says, you can have this job to make a lot of money, that's great, thank you very much. Or you can have this job to make a change in society. When you're 20, you might do either one depending on your experience and desire. You won't necessarily follow the monetary motive. But if you're 50, like I am, you're going to go after it and you're going to look at it and say, hey, I got two kids getting ready to go to college. I got a car that's broke down. I need money. So you might push that. You know, might project that monetary motive on the youth. So corporations have a tendency to do that. Government has a tendency to do that. But it's not necessarily the prime motivations for the people that are doing stuff. You know, if you look at Occupy Wall Street and groups like that, they used social media as a mechanism of collaboration and coordination. We saw that in the G8 riots out in Seattle. We saw that in various things like Occupy DC down there at the park. That's one use of it. Then we also saw overseas groups using it for intelligence gathering and other things. But even beyond all of that, there's even more going on, which is the idea of Anonymous and LoseSec and groups like that. But they're not very effective. I like the guys at Anonymous. They followed me on Twitter. They talked to me via Twitter. They send me emails. It's interesting dealing with some of the guys. But the one thing that they don't have and never have figured out at the hacktivist culture side is how to align politics with strategy, with operations, with tactics. They're great at the tactical side. They can lob grenades at corporations all day long. They're becoming more savvy at media relations, but that's just still tactics. What they haven't been able to do is align their operational plans, procedures, and mechanisms of waging their little wars against people with a strategy that actually accomplishes their objectives. As a really good example, Anonymous, we have no leadership. Well, that's great, except for they do have some leaders. They have thought leaders, but they don't align really well with the operational to strategy side of things. They're getting there and maturing from tactics to operations, but like the old style gangs, they have not really addressed that operations to strategy element.
So let's sort of switch gears a little to, you mentioned operations. So I'm curious about OPSEC. You know, how do we, in a world where, you know, I'm going to switch the roles a little. So instead of, you know, viewing the world as an investigator, I'm going to view the world as a hacker. So when the adversary, when an investigator has access to data and metadata and the powers of the state, I mean, what happens to sort of OPSEC? I mean, I know that we've had the development of Tor, development of IPSEC, but, you know, what does this do to operational security when, you know, you can essentially fingerprint somebody through metadata? Or can you, let me ask it this way, can you fingerprint somebody through metadata? And when I say fingerprint, I'm putting it in quotes.
So I would say, yes, you can. It's not nearly as accurate as fingerprints are, but it's more accurate than a lot of other things. To get a fingerprint or a geolocation or whatever, you can, on mobile devices, it's pretty much guaranteed to get a good idea of what the station ID is and tie it back to a specific device. Not perfect. There's always been ways of cloning devices. But the other thing is you can do a pattern of behavior aligned with the technologies. So really low level would be the fingerprint of your browser. EFF has had stories about this for a decade. And you can look at the browser and say that browser belongs to this user because there's only one out of 100. But more importantly, out of that IP range, that's the only one. So you do by subtraction to get to the actual fingerprint, which isn't quite the same as a fingerprint. I just want to put that out there. But it's good enough for attribution. So for operational security, if you're using the internet and you want to, and you're a bad guy, you are wrong. If you're not out of band, you're wrong, because the very nature of the internet is a transaction-based medium. People always say, "Well, Tor is secure," and I say, get any three really good network hackers in a room and ask them if they could come up with a way to break Tor, and there's been stuff out there about this kind of thing. If two of them agree, then Tor has already been hacked by the government. I'm not saying the government's done it. I'm not saying I have any special knowledge of that. I'm just saying that if under a reasonable approach, if we use reasonableness to assess capability, we can assess Tor and say, if any two good guys go down to DEF CON Black Cat, sit them down in a room and say, could you break Tor? If they say yes, then it's probably been broken. Because the NSA, though, it looks like this dark monolith to most people. Of, you know, they consider it like I don't know, you know, the monolith on Pluto or something. What it really is it's just people like you and I who have a different set of strategies, operations, and tactics that they're applying towards a political purpose. So they have to live in the same world, same physical world as we do, same technological world, and have to apply all those tools in the same way we do. It's just that their purpose, motivations, are different than ours. So if we want to know if something happens, we just look at what their motivations are, and we say, can you do this? If we can come up with a way of doing it, you can be darn sure with the resources they have, they've probably done it. And that's just an approach towards reasonableness and thinking about it. It's just like Verizon, the idea that the government was handing over Verizon data is nothing new. That's been reported for 20 years. It's in the law. You can go read where they have to do that. So if it's in the law and we've had terrorist attacks, don't you think they would be using the tools at their approach? But there's other things there that, and the NSA Snowden thing that are kind of interesting to me, which is the idea that corporations sharing. Here we've had General Alexander saying on multiple occasions, we need to share. We need laws to allow us to do this. Yet apparently they were doing it behind the scenes anyway. So why did we need the laws? And why was he saying we needed that approach if they were already doing it? Because it leaks a motivation. And good old Claude Shannon, theory of information. Anytime you're asking for something, you're leaking either a current capability or a future capability you desire. So I was kind of interested in seeing why he did that. It's not a big deal. It's not even a thing that keeps me up at night for sure, but it's an interesting thing. So from the perception of operational security, if you're working on the internet trying to hide your activities, there's three strategies that we talk about in information warfare and electronic warfare. You can hide in the noise. Great way to do things. Just make sure things are really, really noisy and you can't be pulled out of it. You can obscure the endpoints, which is what Tor does, but you can't just use Tor because every exit point from Tor is a point that you could attack. So you can do things like roll across multiple systems, use a chipping code for communication. You can hide in pictures. You can hide video in pictures. You can hide audio in pictures using steganography. So you can do those kind of things to hide your communications. And the final thing you can do is just communicate openly but in code. So you never use things that people would obviously know. You can say, show up at 8th and I. They're in D.C., and everybody's going to say, well, the Marines will all be there. Well, when you say 8th and I, it's a one-time pad to mean actually show up out in Centerville in D.C. or something like that. You know, it's those are the kind of things you can do to hide your security. I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody. I don't know what their level of sophistication in those are. They may be trying to use crypto and things like that. The problem with crypto is, and it's come out through Snowden, is the simple use of crypto allows us to track you easier.
So then let's expand on crypto. How much, you know, in our current models and our current thinking, where do we place encryption? I mean, it seems like on one hand that if you were to get the hashes, you know, of whatever, you know, encryption, I mean, it seems like with like OCL Hashcat, you know, with people building like sort of GPU servers, I mean, it seems like from the perspective of an outsider like me, it seems like it's going towards the point where encryption is increasingly becoming less useful. That really you have to do sort of pattern management, anonymizing, switching computers, etc. I mean, where do we place encryption in all this?
So crypto is an interesting piece to that, because simple use of crypto makes you a target. And you always have endpoints that are going to identify that you're there. So you have transmitter receiver, or whether if it's full transaction communication, you have two stations on the crypto link. So in the movies, you know, the guy sits down at the command line, types a couple of trace routes, and suddenly they break into the crypto and they can read the communication going on between two entities. Doesn't work like that in the real world. However, if I know where two stations are, I can use all those tools we talked about earlier. You know, I can use Nessus, or I can use scanning tools. I can use Break. I can go grab Metasploit and attack them. I can do serious analysis on the communication strategies between them and use specially crafted hacks against them, and then get inside there, because the endpoints are always the subjective targets for a crypto attack. And so crypto gives some security, but is not perfect security, because analysis attacks against that kind of stuff can occur. And what, apparently that's what, according to, I don't have any real knowledge, I stay away from the Snowden stuff, but according to the stuff I've read from The Guardian, apparently the NSA is keeping all the crypto and saving it forever so that when they have enough computing power, they can break it. I'm kind of amazed that they can't break most crypto that, you know, is as simple as SHA and things like that right away. Maybe they are. I don't know. But the there is definitely a pattern to attacking crypto. What it does give us is it gives you time. And most computer security is exactly that. It gives you time. Between the time you originate a communication and the time that somebody can actually access that communication, you have a window. Most people don't think about it that way, but that's what crypto, that's what information security gives you, is I have a window of time based on current capabilities that I can operate without somebody knowing I did something. And so as long as you understand what that window is, you're good to go. I don't think most people doing bad stuff think about it that way. They think about it completely differently, as if I used crypto so they'll never be able to get in. Not true. I use crypto and it'll take them 6 weeks to get in, 2 weeks to get in, a week to get in, or a few minutes to get in, depending on the level of the crypto. And that's a much better way of looking at it. That's the way information security itself is. The whole concept of defense in depth and things like that is not to protect you against attack. It's to slow down an external attacker so you have a time period of time in which to respond to the attack, to take yourself off the network, to respond in kind, to do whatever. That's what defense in depth and information security is all about, is slowing down the attack, not stopping it. Because in general, you can't stop it. And now with the idea of social media and hyperconnectivity, even the concept of defense in depth doesn't work well. And even the concept of crypto doesn't work so well, because I can put an agent on a telephone through, you know, because you went out and you rooted your iPhone so that you could get the Cydia app to download stuff. And when you did that, I had a little something special put into the phone so that now I'm as if I was you listening to your communication. So you use crypto all day long, but because you have the idea of a rooted phone, now I can do a little something special on your phone, and your crypto is broken. So there's all these endpoint attacks that erode your security and operational security.
So where do we put political protections then? I mean, it seems like if we, you know, go from the operational to the strategic and then the political, you know, where do we place political protections? I mean, is sort of being in line with a certain policy or being in line with a certain corporation or certain, you know, state, you know, offer the adversary protection?
Well, this is a good point. You know, one of the things is that at the political layer, when we're looking down towards the other things, we've stepped out of the realm of technology being our prime motivation, and technology as it exists, and now we're into the policy realm, and guys like me that came out of nuts and bolts information technology, information security, we get really, really uncomfortable talking about policy, even though everybody kind of tries to drag us up to that level. That's what they have to do, drag us up to that level, because they don't really understand what's going on. So you see governments doing things like Haystack and things like that, trying to protect insurgencies, or they do other things like provide electronic warfare aircraft to go look at insurgencies, depending on which side you're on. What I find is that we're seeing ideological alignments, and I don't have any real good data on this. I've been reading quite a bit trying to figure out where society's going. Since Occupy Wall Street kind of has fizzled, I've been kind of interested in watching what's the next thing coming that could be. And we look for trigger events, and I thought the NSA would be with Snowden would be a trigger event, but it really hasn't caused that kind of outrage that an Occupy Wall Street kind of fed on in the 2008 financial crisis. So I think what we see is hacker groups are aligning along their practice groups. So in the hacker world, I've watched, and they divide along agencies of practice. So the network guys all hang out together, the kernel guys all hang out together, the malware guys all hang out together, the forensics guys all hang out together, and they divide that way and find themselves aligning ideologically along those groups. And I'm not sure what happens with this in the future as we see different trigger events in society that are external to their cultural foundations. It's going to be interesting. You live in interesting times, maybe an ancient curse, but it also is kind of fun.
For our last bit of conversation, I want to talk about weapons and sort of cyber conflict, the weapons used in cyber conflict. I mean, my first question is, the idea of weapons and the idea of a conflict. I mean, are these terms accurate? Because it seems like in DC especially, we try to define the problem of cyber through the state. So the Talon manual, we try to discuss it through international law, through, the laws of the state and, international society at large. But I mean, how do we define cyber conflict and weapons? Especially considering in our conversation, we've talked about, individuals, corporations, states, etc.
So the first thing is that there's bias of definitions, which is a policy mechanism used by groups to say, I'm going to talk about cyber and it means X. If you talk to the NSA guys who are signals intelligence guys, and they come out of the world of networks, to them, cyber is all about the network. If you go talk to the big data guys, cyber is all about data analysis. If you go talk to the telco guys, it's all about communications and collaboration conduits. So they're looking at the OCs and the Ts and all those kind of networking kind of things. Each group builds cyber around it. I'm more of a cohesive model guy. I like the holistic style. I like to bring all those pieces in and look at processing, storage, and transmission as all pieces of cyber. And that overlaying that, the crunchy outside of cyber is content, and collaboration. The Dan Keel, a professor at Mercyhurst, came up with those ideas. And so the government has their way of doing things. And since government, by treaty and law and obligation, can only act against other governments, they always focus all of their interest on external entities that are other nation states. So a lot of the conversation gets to be talking about that. If you talk to a Jay Healey or any of those guys, they'll say that war can only happen between two nation states. Lots of conflict can rise to the level that we would say, look at it as reasonable individuals and say, that's war. But they would say, no, it's an insurgency. It's a this, it's that, it's a criminal enterprise. But to anybody else looking at it, it's war. So that's the first piece. Me, I use the word cyber conflict because I can use cyber as an adjunct to a conflict, I can use it as a primacy to conflict, or I can use it as a response, as a defense in conflict. I can do all kinds of things. It can be the environment that I'm operating in. It can be the weapon I'm using, or it can be the target. So that's a hard concept for a lot of people to understand. But if you think about the ocean, and I like to use ocean metaphors, I have a lot of time on the sea. The ocean in and of itself is the terrain. I can use it as a defense mechanism by using a tool like a submarine to hide within that terrain. Or the ocean itself, I can explode a device in it and use the kinetic power of the ocean to destroy a target at the sea's edge. There's a lot of things there, right? A lot of nice, neat metaphors. All metaphors break down after time, but that's a nice kind of a way of thinking about it.
But does the state have a particular advantage, though? I mean, it seems like...
No. I would say that the state, because all all nation states have bureaucracy. I would say that in acquisition of cyber weapons, unless the people doing it are following a special operations command model for acquisition, you should think about the high drag of an acquisition process like the Joint Strike Fighter. Governments inherently have a hard time adapting and acquiring any technology of worth or note. Now, the neat thing is for governments is that they don't necessarily have to acquire things that are open source. And all these guys out there got 0 days or acquiring them. All the contractors are buying up 0 days, supposedly. And so there's an entire group that's feeding that machinery on the back end. But we can see from our own view, if we look at what's going on in the community of people that would be our weapons designers and creators, we can watch that community and have a pretty good idea what a government has. But then again, nothing's stopping us from going and watching Bug Track, Security Focus, all the bulletins coming out from Microsoft, and analyzing all that stuff ourselves and saying, we want to be weapons creators and owners also. So every nation out there has the ability to come up to this regardless of their financial wherewithal. With the U.S. government and other nation states have that they do have, they do well, is they have the ability to collaborate, coordinate, and task appropriately along that stream. So they get stuff in, they can utilize it faster than other people. I look at cyber weapons a couple of ways. One is that we have old school cyber weapons based on the idea of kinetics, electronic warfare cyber weapons. The classic example, and I don't really agree with it, would be an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse. If I blow that off, I will degrade, disrupt, or destroy your electronic capability. Regardless of most people's concerns, that's a pretty effective cyber weapon. We have Generation 2 cyber weapons. And those are the weapons that we're usually talking about in the hacker culture. It's the idea of we have an exploit-based example where we can go in and say, we know that this buffer overflow will work, so we can exploit it, create an access, and utilize that to do other bad stuff. That's a kind of a Generation 2. And Generation 3 is a fusion of the first two generations where I have a push button way of exploiting a system sitting in front of me that nobody's really thought about. And that's where we're going. It's the idea of the average soldier on the field has no technical capability within the computing realm, but he's got some device, you know, he's got a cyber rifle. I hate to say that, but because people make fun of it, but he's got something he can point at another bad guy and pull the trigger and it wipes it out, does whatever it needs to wipe it out. Maybe it's an EMP gun. I don't know. I don't have to know. That's the neat thing about being an academic. I can make it up on the fly. But the thing is that we do know that we are looking towards that kind of capability. However it will be shown in the future, that's where we're going.
So let me ask you, I think a lot of us, like people who are not necessarily involved in the day-to-day of information security, have this view of how cyber weapons are deployed. You know, we sort of picture, you know, the joke I like to tell is that, you know, it's a very neat GUI. It's very neat, you know, sort of like Sandra Bullock in The Net or the movie Hackers. I don't, this sounds silly, but I mean, how are sort of cyber weapons used and deployed? You know, I mean, it seems like, you know, it strikes me there's a difference between a Stuxnet that was very, very much specifically designed for that particular Iranian system versus, you know, something like Metasploit or even, you know, Aircrack. I mean, sort of walk us through. I mean, how are cyber weapons deployed and used?
So it's platform dependent. So if you wanted to take over a nuclear refining facility in a third nation, in some other nation, you would have to craft for that environment, right? Well, it's no different. Wherever you're going to go. So the general concept is you have a tasking. We need an exploit. We need an access to a computing system, whether it's for espionage, disabling a system, destroying a system, or disinformation, whatever it is. You know, maybe we want to get in and change all the payroll records so people get pissed off, whatever the access is. There'll be a tasking that goes along with that. So then the tasking comes down to a capabilities assessment. We see this entity that we want to accomplish this tasking against, we want to go after that. So then they'll say, well, what are the surfaces that we can bounce off of, and what are the connectivities of those surfaces? So reconnaissance is a really good start for that. And reconnaissance does not necessarily mean go ping their systems. That's not a good way to do things. But it might be read up on them, evaluate, use analysis strategies, determine a set of accesses, and then operationalize an exploit. So it might be a buffer overflow, it might be a zero-day exploit, it might be a side channel attack, it might be send an email to their vendor that allows you access to their dial home system that the vendor uses. It can be a lot of different ways. You'll operationalize some access to the system and run your exploit package against that system based on your desired end goal. So in doing this, you know, a lot of people sit down and they'll scan the web, and they'll look for all the web servers. Well, the first thing that anybody with any sense is going to do is disconnect their web servers or make them read-only so that they don't give you anything, and maybe put their web servers in one location and all of their design capabilities in another location. So there's a lot going on there, but I can do analysis to gain access. It's a non-trivial approach. There's no good sexy UI to do this kind of stuff. But what you do at that point in time is you operationalize the access, you use your exploit path to get in, do whatever you want, create a foothold in the system, accomplish whatever your tasking is that you're trying to do, maybe cover your tracks, maybe create a disinformation, say, oh, I'm from China, I'm from, you know, some other country that's been noisy lately, and then back out of the system with whatever access I've done. So if I want to go after a generator turbine system in a major dam in a country, I might not jump through a whole bunch of hoops, because two-thirds of the internet goes to the United States. I can attack from the United States with pretty much impunity, because everybody attacks from the United States. When Estonia was attacked, that was a big piece to it. But the other thing is that I would then look at the systems I was going to attack, craft my exploit code for that target, and then operationalize them. And that's kind of the pattern to what you do, and it's really dependent on what the target of opportunity is.
So, I mean, what do you do in the sense of not just, you know, attacker and attackee, but something like a botnet? I mean, in the sense of, you know, it seems like a lot of botnets, all they do is shoot out spam, or, you know, they try to, you know, or to do sort of black hat SEO. I mean, what is, you know, where do we put a botnet in this sort of conversation?
Botnets are really interesting, because, you know, you have the standard things botnets are used for. You know, like you said, black hat kind of SEO, search engine optimization, maybe a little bit on the spam side, maybe a lot on the spam side. But there's another really kind of cool thing. You know, botnets represent a huge amount of computing power. I mean, we're talking, when some of these botnets were up and running, they represented the largest computing infrastructure on the planet. And think what you could do with an appropriate spanning botnet. And this is nothing new. Back in the, the guys that did the SETI at home thing, they used that same whole process to do analysis of SETI data. So that's nothing new, but imagine processing as your weapon, because I can now break certain things you have. I can break codes, I can do high-speed analysis, I can do de-anonymization, I can use the botnet as a sensor network to tell where your exit node for your Tor is at. I can do all kinds of crazy stuff. I can do anonymization. I can layer on top of the botnet a communications channel that bounces so many places it's literally impossible to take apart, or I can chip a message across 50 or 60 channels within a botnet. And, you know, if you have 2 million nodes in a botnet, you'd be able to chip across a 50 unit channel across that in such a way as it'd be darn near impossible to see where it came out. I'm not saying it's impossible, it'd be darn near impossible, at least in human time, to be able to do that. So, botnets represent a really sophisticated method of anonymization and de-anonymization that people really haven't investigated yet.
So then, let me ask you a question about, pen testing. I mean, it seems like, we talk about very specific weapons, but it seems like, with penetration testing and sort of, Linux distributions like Backtrack and with Kali, the ability to sort of access, some of these tools, not necessarily, crafting new and original malware or, new and original Trojans or worms, but rather it seems like a lot more people with basic computer knowledge will have access to what, some would call a cyber weapon. I mean, is this...
Oh, yeah.
In the sense that, do you see this as a positive or a negative? I mean, it seems like, you're bringing in a lot more, brighter people, not brighter people, but a lot more talent and people into the industry. But at the same time, anybody could run Metasploit. Anybody could go to Rapid7 and sort of, download or utilize the community version of Metasploit. I mean, is this, the ability to access these tools, do you see this as, a positive on the whole, or do you think it's a negative, or it's more of a neutral phenomenon that we have to deal with?
So I think of it a couple of different ways. One is it's the democratization of the entire space, the cyberspace, because what happens is now more people are aware of a core capability that's existed for a long period of time. So if people are out there doing a risk assessment on their corporation and they've been exposed to Metasploit, or they've been exposed to a variety of tools. And I'm so old, I remember when Juggernaut came out in 2600 in the frags. When you've been exposed to port scanning tools and analysis tools and Nmap and things like that, you understand how they work and how they are good and bad. I still see companies with scan teams. Teams that do nothing but hook into various segments of the network and scan their entire network with a Nessus tool or an Nmap tool. Now that sounds really, really good. They're being proactive is what we would say. However, if I'm a bad guy and I'm on the network and I listen to all of that traffic because I don't have a really good map, you've just given me a really good map to what your network looks like. So if I'm in there listening silently in reconnaissance mode, your security practice just made you insecure. That's a side to this that a lot of people don't look at. But when you understand the capability of the tool, and I say that to you as a leader because you grew up with these tools, you suddenly go, aha, that's not necessarily good. We need to make sure that we're clean before we start this process, or we need to make sure, watch for an exfiltration of that kind of data. So this is an interesting piece to this that I think is starting to be noticed. And so the tools have always existed. More people are becoming aware of them. It's also got a good piece to it in the sense that more people are becoming aware of them. The bad piece is that core ethics and values on the internet do not necessarily follow social norms. And people are willing to do negative stuff to each other and the internet that they would never do in person. And so we're starting to see that. And there's also some social philosophy stuff that comes into the current experts in internet culture and information security are not known for their social capability of getting along. Every time I see an IT guy calling their users losers, I often reflect on I fired people for doing that in the past. Because you no longer can be trusted by your user community, you've lost your value to me as an IT commodity. But that's the, we're starting to see less of that as this whole convergence of social norms and social practices are instantiated in technology by things like bring your own device. So that's the end game in this entire environment, is everybody will have a device, and it won't be provided by your corporation. It'll be your device. It's going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. I can't see any way for it not to happen as we're moving forward. But when that happens, what happens to all those IT guys and security guys?
So let me end our conversation with, you know, what is the appropriate response for being hacked? And I'm not talking about like an individual. I'm talking about a corporation or a state, because I think in my previous conversations with Packet Knife and Cryptica, you know, I asked them this very question. You know, does a corporation look to the government to counter a threat, or does it, you know, build up its defenses and, you know, hack back? You know, what is, you know, what is the appropriate response? Because it seems like, you know, I think Ali in my conversation with him and Scott, he just laughed at me when I mentioned, you know, corporations sort of advocating for hack back. But I mean, what's your viewpoint? What do you see as, you know, the appropriate sort of response for being hacked?
For American corporations that are now considered corporeal, the corporation has a fictional existence as a human being, I think legally there will be a set of principles in the future allowing, under Second Amendment, for the idea of a weapon to be used in self-defense. I think that that's going to happen. I wrote a journal article with one of my students a while back in Iowa Journal on the idea of self-defense in cyber. And we're not attorneys, so we're not going to do that. No corporate counsel today is going to jump on and say, hey, we need to do this. As far as notifying the government, every general counsel that's had law class one in cyber has heard about the Steve Jackson Games debacle, which was the Steve Jackson Games was the provider of tools that there was a book that was banned, the Anarchist Cookbook. And they had on their servers, so the Secret Service showed up and took every one of their servers. Not just the one with the book, but every one of them, because that's what the warrant said. And it darn near put the company out of business. There's a Wikipedia article on it if you want to read it. But every corporate counsel that's been out there knows that case and knows that if you call the law enforcement agencies in, they now own the crime scene. The crime scene is your systems. And that's your core capability for your business or your core business aspect, it could be extremely bad. And we started to talk a little bit about cloud and things like that. What that means with the cloud, I have no idea where that's going to go. But that idea of hack back. Now, there is another piece to this, which is poisoning the well. If I have computing systems that I run, and those systems have stuff that other people want to get to, and I protect those systems, and I put stuff on my systems that are really, really negative to be activated, but some guy hacks into my computing system and takes that stuff out and activates it on his system and beacons to me where he exists, destroys his systems in place, and destroys all the systems around him, that's not on me. He's the one that activated him. It's the booby trap philosophy. And so if I've poisoned the well and you've done that, you've activated that little booby trap, that's not on me. Is that hack back or not? You know? And so we're starting to see people talk about that. Integrity of data, selective changing of data, the idea of doing those kind of things as an active defense mechanism. If you want to see a case like this, it was reported in Richard Clark's book. It's been reported on the web. There was a case of this with supposedly, I'm not saying it's real, that's never been verified, and there is criticism that it didn't actually happen. But the Russians downloaded software from a Canadian company that the CIA supposedly changed, and it caused a pipeline to explode. That's supply chain hacking in some ways, but in this case, it really what it is that they poisoned the well. So this is a principle that's existed for some time.
So do we consider, you know, a DDoS to be an attack then? I mean, it seems like, you know, I think that, you know, in the news that it's usually denial of service, the denial of service attacks on the bank, denial of service, you know, attacks on, you know, Reddit, if you consider Reddit a business. But, you know, I mean, it seems like in this conversation that we've never really defined what constitutes an attack on a corporation, or, I mean, I think it's clear what an attack on a government is, but what is an attack on a corporation, on a non-government entity?
So a DDoS and an attack is in the eye of the beholder. A really good example is Amazon. When Amazon kicked WikiLeaks off, they said, oh, we're going to attack you, and they did a DDoS on Amazon. And that was reported in the news, and the news called up Amazon and said, you're being DDoSed by the WikiLeaks crowd. What do you think about that? And they went, we are? because the amount of traffic that they could generate to attack Amazon didn't even register as an event on their systems.
Wow.
So you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. If you're a small corporation and 100 guys get together and packet flood you, you're going to, you know, and you're at one server connected to your cable modem at home, you're going to have a bad day. And so that, you have to consider that. What is an attack? It has a lot to do with what is the nature of it. Then again, one really well-crafted exploit that attacks the configuration file of a particular server could take down all of Amazon's cloud, right? We know because a technician did that in the Dulles zone. So that would be really, really catastrophic if somebody figured out how to replicate that. And so if they did that, it would be, you know, we'd be able to apply and say something happened, it was criminal, and we'd be able to apply all the tests of law. So it really is in the eye of the beholder. And I'm not sure we've got a good handle on what that means, because the idea of selectivity and capability of the victim being part and parcel of the event is brand new to us. Our laws are not written that way. And so I'm not sure where that goes. That I've listened to some really good arguments by attorneys, but every attorney argues from the aspect of they're a prosecutor, a defendant, or a defense attorney, and so they always argue the law from their perspective. So I've never got a really good definitive how we are going to handle this in the future.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like with, you know, the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I mean, it seems like the definition is as loose as possible, and it's largely up to, as to your point, to the victim. Because it seems like, you know, I think today Andrew Arnheimer, or whatever his name is, he had an article out on TechCrunch. So he went to, for those who are listening, he went to prison for accessing a public API. It was like a flaw. He reported to AT&T, and then AT&T said, shrugged their shoulders. So he went to Gawker. But, I mean, it seems like, you know, to your point, though, the legal infrastructure is really not falling behind, but it's pretty loose. I think with other crimes like assault or with battery or with even murder, like it's clear what that crime is. But with computer crime, it doesn't seem as clear. What do you think about this?
Some of this is by construction, and I'm no attorney, so right. I'm not claiming expertise I don't have. But some of this is by construction. In the 1970s, there was a case in LA that a company was doing things, and they said, hey, this guy stole our software, old mainframes kind of guys. And the judge went, hey, how can this be a crime of theft? Because you still have it. Theft is denying that. So it's not a crime of theft. And so we ended up, that's where U.S. computer law really got its start as we see it today. It was one judge not understanding the idea of, if I make a copy of something, it's a forgery, and thereby theft of my intellectual property, and thereby a theft of my ability to sell the product in the future. So the judge didn't understand that concept when they charged him with a standard property crime of theft. And so they basically started rewriting things. And if you look, 1980, you end up with a bunch of computer law on the books that gives us the CFAA, and we start 1984 and 86 and 90s. They update and amend it. half the CFAA is about national security systems. So a lot of people don't understand that a lot of that's about federal government systems and national security systems are a special classification of those. And the other half is about everybody else. And so we start seeing these things move forward and the case law adapt. And so the adaptability of technology around the law is a relatively new phenomenon. Today, if I show you a gun, you might differentiate it and say that's an automatic, that's a revolver, that's a submachine gun, that's an AK-47. You might differentiate that. But if I say gun, you know what it is. And if I say weapon, you still know what it is. In computing, one day the weapon is a wall, and the next day it's artillery. And so one is defensive and one is an active offensive weapon. And they act completely differently in how we see them. So making a law against one, you could actually make the corporation less secure. So you end up with a series of problems and conundrums. And that all comes from that original 1970s case, in my opinion, and moving it forward.
I mean, what does that do to forensics then? I mean, it seems like, you know, if you can't define a crime or you define that crime rather poorly, you know, I mean, what does that do in terms of, does that affect, you know, how the legal construction behind forensics?
Absolutely. But the thing is that in and of itself, forensics rarely is about investigating a crime that the computer in and of itself is the agency of the crime. Almost all forensics that we do, behavior was the thing that we're looking at. We're looking at some behavior that somebody did with a computer, but it isn't the agent of the crime, or the computer is the victim of the crime, or more specifically, is the witness of the crime. So they saw what happened. The computer is how we know that they were doing something. So like bank fraud or something like that. So another crime was done and the computer witnessed it, or the computer was the victim. We investigate it from that aspect. The thing that happens, though, is that the CFAA crimes with the computer are rarely proven just with the computer. They're usually proven with other aspects of the investigation, too. There's not just part and parcel of what we do.
Okay. I mean, we've sort of reached the end of the interview. I mean, we usually like to give the guest the last word or the last word. So, I mean, give us a sort of a roundup or a summary or, you know, a last comment for the audience.
So all I would say is that we are in the midst of change. We've been in the midst of change since the idea of the internet came into being in the 1960s. It's a social political upheaval that's occurring. It's economic. I mean, who ever thought that Microsoft would be as large as it is, or Apple would be as large as it is? You know, in 1980s, I remember when everybody said, you know, this upstart Apple will be gone in 5 years. And now look at it. And, you know, I remember guys at Microsoft making jokes about Apple. Our entire social fabric has changed because of technology. And at the same time, it's trivial changes. You know, I still have to go buy my food from a farmer. I still have to buy gas from a guy that drills in the ground. None of that stuff has been cyberized. But what has happened is that they have used the cyber as a way of being more efficient, making better profit. We still have the pieces of our society there that don't have that cyber frosting on them that are hard for people in the technology world to really realize. But on the other side of it, what we're seeing now is things that never had a cyber component to them have a huge cyber component. In my discipline in computer forensics, it's expanding it rapidly, like cars. The idea of self-driving cars was not even probable when I was growing up as a thought that it would actually occur. We had science fiction about it, but we didn't ever think it would exist. Google Glasses are going to be witness to crimes, and how we deal with the cyber evidence from these things is going to be amazing to see how we actually process through this. so many things in our lives have a cyber component now that it's sitting there bearing witness to our tragedies and successes in life and the crimes and victimization that occur in life too. It's going to be an amazing thing to see how this discipline and how this thing we call cyber moves forward. I have no idea where it's going in the long term, but it's kind of fun to watch.
Interesting. So thank you so much for coming on.
No problem.
Thank you.
Love being here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, no problem.